The second one is loss. Now, that's loss of anything that is emotionally significant. It could be the gum trees you love in your garden, the environment, the landscape, well, also your house, also money. A lot of people come out the other end financially not nearly as well off as they ever were before. And loss of all sorts of things. Loss of connections. Loss of relationships. I was out at Hall's Gap after the big flash floods there a few years ago. And after I finished my talk, a man came up to me and said, "I lost my house in the Ash Wednesday fires." And he said, "My closest friend was my cousin. We'd grown up together. We spent our holidays together. We got married at the same time. We brought our kids up together. We went on holidays and camps and everything." He rang me up after the fires and said, "You weren't affected by that terrible fire, were you?" He said, "Yep, we lost absolutely everything." Oh my goodness, dear. But you'll be all right, won't you?" And he said, yeah, we'll survive, we'll get through this." Good. He's never heard from him again. You see, you'll find that there are some people around you who have been in your personal support networks who can't deal with it, or who maybe say well-meaning but completely irrelevant and insensitive things. Pull yourself together, you should get on with it. I'm sure if you were looking on the bright side and smiled a bit, you'd feel a lot better, or whatever, you know. Bless their hearts, it means they haven't actually been through the experience where they've been on their uppers and they can't really deal with it. But you'll find that. And, you know, some people say down the track, they get to a point where one woman said, "I culled my friends. I worked out who was really important and actually there for me and giving me, and who was, you know, playing on obligations and responsibilities and wasn't really giving me, and I just took a hard decision and I just didn't put any time into those," and so on. So this is loss. There's a whole range of losses that can continue to start occurring, and it becomes very important to deal with the losses that you can't change, that the fire brings, but really be aware of and protect the losses that can unfold during the recovery period. But the third factor I want to speak about is, so we've got trauma, loss and disruption. And this is, I reckon, one of the most important factors. And potentially, it's one of the ones we should be able to minimise disruption. Now, let me just speak about this. If you think about it, so I'll just put this in a little simple story. If you think about it, the way in which we organise our lives so that we've got space to think and plan and reflect is to develop routines, don't we? You know, you try and put your pyjamas in the same drawer, you keep the sugar in the same place, you know, and the pots and pans, at least the wives do, the husbands can never remember that. Right, so we tried it. Now, what does that mean? That means if life is going well, you can get up in the morning, you know, get dressed, have your breakfast and go off to work, and you don't have to think about anything. And all of that time, your brain can be freewheeling. So you can be talking about to yourself about, you know, the problems you had yesterday and how you might deal with them. You can be worrying about the problems you've got tomorrow. You can be making plans. You can be working things out. You can be rehearsing stuff. I call this mulling time. Mulling. You know, mulling over, chewing over, like cows chew their cud. We chew our cuds too. It's mulling time. It's absolutely essential for us to do that. because it gives us the opportunity to do things that happen between the lines, like get things into perspective. Now, it's going to be very hard to get this fire into perspective without mulling time to digest things, to process the emotion so that you're no longer in this sort of swirling up and down of emotion. You gradually settle it down and start to see the issues. Problem solving, weighing up options and so on. These are really important things for us to do. And the problem is that we didn't know we were doing it when we're in routine. I had probably my last visit to Christchurch late last year. It was my eighth visit. One of the earlier visits, they had just done a well-being survey of the city. And one of the issues that people identified as a major stressor was the continuous roadworks. Now, has anyone been to Christchurch since the earthquake? Well, I noticed there was a bit of roadworks on the way down here, but there, as soon as it gets dark, well, not even, as soon as it's after 5 o'clock, out they come with a witch's hat and start digging up the roads. And the problem is that because all the pipes have been, you know, they've got to actually put pumps in and pump the sewerage up over the lump into the next bit of the sewers, and they have to do that every night. And it's going to probably take them quite a few years before they can get all this underground structures replaced. So that you never know whether it's going to take you 15 minutes or 45 minutes to get to work. And you never know whether this road's blocked and you're going to go around that road until you wake up in the morning and get in the car. So they said, why is that? And I said, well, you see, all you need to lose that mulling time is to have to deal with very simple, trivial problems. You've got to just apply your mind, and you can't do that mulling and digesting and perspective and reflection and so on. And this then means that the most important things, which is what's the right decision here? What do I really want? How do I work through that emotion so that when I talk to that person next, I don't start yelling at them, but, you know, thinking about the issue? You know, how am I planning ahead or trying to see a way around this particular problem and so on? You lose that. And so your stress sort of just massively increases. So that if you then move into a lifestyle that's continuously trying to improvise around a whole lot of unpredictable situations, your perspective becomes narrower and narrower. You know, where did I put my pyjamas? Where are the saucepans again? Whose kitchen am I in? What'll I do? You know, people have talked about, I know women have told me that they really enjoyed cooking, and cooking was one of their times where they just get in the kitchen and they just forget all their problems and they just make this beautiful meal and be very happy. But all you need to lose that capacity is to be in somebody else's kitchen and then in somebody else's kitchen. And, you know, and you've got to be working out where are the pots and so on and so forth. How does this oven work? All these trivia. And you can multiply that by every problem you've got. And so this element of disruption, it like creates friction around everything. So I think a very important principle is, as if your life has been significantly disrupted, try to give attention to how you can establish routines and rhythms in your life again. They mightn't be the same ones, but really try and do that. Try and think about it. How do we do it? How do we... Let me add one more thing. You see, how I've had to ask myself, trying to understand the problems that people have during the recovery period, how do we integrate into the nitty-gritty fabric of our lives the values, principles, ideals that really are important and make our life meaningful? You see, the thing I'm really concerned about is that people don't come out the end. I mean, there is a certain amount of risk that people will have mental health problems, right? Anxiety states, depression, post-traumatic stress. But most people don't. Well, they don't tick all the boxes. They might only tick one or two, but that doesn't give you a diagnosis of a mental health disorder. But it does make you vulnerable to suffering what I call degraded quality of life, like Bill. Bill was not sick. If he was really sick, he'd go to the doctor and get antidepressants or whatever. But Bill's life didn't make sense to him anymore. There was no joy in it. And he didn't feel like socialising, going and seeing his friends. So he was living an isolated lifestyle. He was lonely. But he didn't feel like talking to people who didn't understand what he'd been through. But he also didn't want to go back to the town where he'd come from because it was associated with bad feelings. Now, you know, when the medical researchers go into it, they find that loneliness is a risk factor for heart disease that's equivalent to smoking. You know, it increases your risk by, I don't know, 25% or other. You know, we put all this money on quits and plain paper packaging and so on, but actually loneliness is just as important. But loneliness is a serious risk after disasters because everyone's starts off feeling we've been through this together, but actually you've been through it together, but it has a different meaning for everyone, doesn't it? Even two houses. If two people lose their house, the house means something different to people, you know? You know, how do we come to terms with that? So what we typically find is this an early period of high morale, altruism, mutual support, and then this tension starts to build as people get tired and irritable and start to feel, well, hang on, you're insured but I'm not, and you're able to get this payment and I'm not, and you were there and I wasn't, and, you know, there are so many differences. What a house means, it's not the same for everyone. Some people evacuate early and lose everything. Other people stay, protect their house, have a traumatic event that leads them to say, I'd never do that again, I'd rather lose my entire house. And then when they talk to each other, one of them says, well, it's all very well for you, you've just lost stuff. I'm totally traumatised, I can't live my life. And the other one says, it's all very well for you, you're just miserable about some emotional problems. I've lost everything I own. Don't you get that? You see, and now it's very hard to empathise with somebody else's problem when we're in the middle of one ourselves. Have you ever had a raging toothache and tried to be sympathetic to someone who had a migraine? You know, it's hard. And that's what it's going to be like. So that we need to be aware of this and try to, as much as possible, depersonalise these reactions. Say, oh, okay, he's in that space. Because here's a very simple principle. Stress makes us egocentric, me. When I'm stressed, it's all about me surviving my problems. Right? And we need to recognise that and realise, actually, we've got to do it together as a couple, as a family, as a community. And we'll have to make decisions to kind of keep understanding and moving beyond this tendency to go burrowing into ourselves.